Good morning, welcome back to Nachiyami. Today we're going to be learning together Daniel Perek Gimel, the third chapter of the book of Daniel. This is a self-contained story, and these 33 psukim tell the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and the statue. Very famous story, all included in this perek. Again, the perek is in Aramaic, so when one learning through this, one can try the Aramaic, one can also use Hebrew and the English as crutches as to be able to help understand what is going on over here. One should also notice that this perek does not include Daniel, although it was in the book of Daniel. Daniel is not included at all. He's not mentioned whatsoever. This is the only perek in his sefer that this is true. Let's look at it in small sections, and we'll think about a few points to ponder after each section. The first seven psukim describe the following episode. It's the construction of the statue. Nebuchadnezzar constructs a statue, which is 60 amos, 60 cubits high, and is made fully of gold in the Dura Valley in Babylon. He then summons all his government officials, all the people who are under his employ and his control, and he orders them in all the languages that when they hear a particular music that's playing, they need to prostrate themselves and bow down in front of this image. Anyone who does not comply with this will be thrown into the fiery furnace. And this is what happens. The music is played and everybody prostrates themselves. Before we go further, just a couple points to ponder. First of all, is why is he doing this? What has got into his head that he needs to do this? A statue of that size made out of gold is an extremely expensive venture to undertake. Even when you look at the annals of history of how it was when France sent the Statue of Liberty to New York to America, you have to understand the incredible financial obligation that made both on France and America. America had to play for the base and how they raised the money. It was not simple. That's now we're talking about bronze and stone. Now we're talking about a golden statue. Why would he go to such trouble? So the Chidah, the Metzudah, David explained that because he saw in the dream that Daniel just interpreted for him that ultimately the kingdom of heaven would prevail over the four kingdoms. And he wanted the kingdom of heaven to fail. So the way he did this was he wanted everybody, specifically the Jews, to bow down to the statue, thereby losing their chelek of the Elokei HaShemayim, of Hashem, the God in heaven, by bowing down to another power, which would therefore free him up from being avenged by the God in heaven. So this is trying to break the we'll call it the fate that he felt that he was locked into. However, the Malbim expands this idea into not being so much about the Jews and the kingdom of heaven, but rather about trying to undo the dream as a whole. So in the dream, if you remember, the statue that he saw in the dream that Daniel explained in Perek Beis in Sefer Daniel was a large, large statue which had a golden head, silver chest and arms, a copper abdomen and legs and feet made of iron and clay, representing all the four kingdoms. What he did was he reconstructed the statue all in gold because gold was representing the kingdom of Babylon. He wanted him to be the only power in the world. And by having the ceremony in which there would be everybody, all these priests bowing down to it, all these government officials and their constituents bowing down, he felt that he'd be able to reverse the effects of the dream and thereby maintain himself being the ultimate power in this world. So this wasn't so much about the nation of Israel, the Jews, it was more about him maintaining his power and his fiefdom. Another question, where is the Dura Valley? There's a lot of discussion about this in archaeological scholarship. Some suggest that this is an area called, it is southeast of Babylon, where there's a small river and there are mounds that bear the name Da'ir or Duar. That was perhaps where it was. There are others who say that it actually might be referring to the actual city of Babylon itself, because the Great Wall was called Duru. So maybe it's referring to he made this in the city itself. So this is a pilgrimage site that he had created for himself. There's a lot of just different speculations. There are those others who say it's a small city called Duru in the neighborhood of Erech. There's a lot of interesting discussions as to where this is. Chazal add a non-archaeological but rather philosophical insight, and that is that the Dura Valley was in fact the place where the people of the Anshe Dor HaPalaga HaFlaga created their tower to rally against God. And in a similar way, he was using a place which was already perhaps used in a similar way to unite humanity against God, is the way that Chazal look at this. We move into the next section, which is Psukim Ches to Yud Beis. In this section, it's now about the slander. What happens is the Chaldeans reported that the three Jewish advisors, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, who are, of course, Hanan, Mishael, and Azariah, will not bow when they hear the music. And they don't pay to, they make the claim that these individuals don't pay attention to the king's words and don't serve his God. So just a couple of things to think about when looking at this section is that, why are they doing this? Why are the Chaldeans doing this? Why are the custom doing this? So the Malbim explains, because this was an attack on Judaism. They were saying that all these people who were brought in front of the statue were people who had constituents, people who were in charge of large segments of the population. And if they were to fail to do it, then their constituents would also fail to bow down to the statue and give their homage to the god of the Babylonians. And he was pointing out that this was an issue with religion. These peoples, their religion, which was forcing them not to bow down, therefore all their followers would also not be for complying as well. The Alshich points out that if we were to view this as an attack on the Malchus Shemaim, on those who served the kingdom of heaven, then it makes sense that the people they were sensitive about not bowing down were the Jews, because that was the whole point of this whole operation. I do think that as well there's an element of xenophobia which can be inputted over here. Here you have the Chaldeans, who are Babylonian nationals, who feel that they, perhaps there were other foreign prodigies who came into their ranks and were successful, and they're using this as an opportunity to oust them. That could also be certainly a part that's going on over here. Why is Daniel not accused as well? Surely he was one of the advisors of the king. So the Malbim explains that technically it was only people who are appointed over constituents. Daniel was so high up in the government echelons that he had no constituents, so he was not actually under the rubric of this decree. We move into the next section, the third section, Psukim Yud Gimel to Yud Ches, in which the king gives them an ultimatum. He gets very, very angry. He summons them to his presence, and he presents them with a very basic binary option. When you hear the music, you bow down, or you get thrown into the fire. And they respond that they don't even need to respond to him, because they will not bow down to his God. And he taunts them by saying, well, let's see what will happen to your God. And his response is that no, that their God will ultimately save them. Just a point to ponder is were they actually supposed to do this? Were they supposed to take umbrage and not go into the fire? So the Rambam points out, when quoting the halachas of Kiddush Hashem, that this was the ultimate Kiddush Hashem in history. This was when people that were forced by the decree of the king to commit Avodah Zarah, pagan worship, and it was in public, and they did Kiddush Hashem Barabim through this. However, it is interesting to note that the Gemara in Psachim and Nun Gimel Amud Beis does quote a brisa which is Toshma. Rabbi Tudus Ishroimi had the following question: why do they throw themselves into the fiery furnace? And he quotes a example that they learned from the frogs in Egypt, who put themselves even in the furnace. And the Tosfos, quoting Rabbeinu Tam, the grandson of Rashi, points out that by the fact that the way the Gemara asks in such a way, when we know that you have to always take your life or give your life if it were to be the Avodah Zarah, pagan worship, which is at stake, and the fact that Gemara is even asking indicates that this wasn't pagan worship. The statue was not a deity. It was actually an andarta. It was a image of Nebuchadnezzar himself, and this is submission. And they were putting their foot down even in this degree because this would seem like Avodah Zarah. And this comes into an interesting discussion that's going to be had later on in the times of Mordechai and Esther, when Mordechai went up bow down to Haman. Was it because of some sort of token pagan deity on his neck, or was it because of just himself submitting to such a power? This becomes the same discussion which is surrounding this issue over here. It should be noted that for a vast majority of all the Mevarshim understand this to be Avodah Zarah Mamish, which means full Avodah Zarah, and that's why they were correct. And it was absolutely the right thing. Rabbeinu also says it's the right thing, but perhaps the stakes were not as high. This is more of an issue of principle than it was actually about Avodah Zarah per se as well. We move into the next section, the fourth section, where they're actually thrown into the fire. The king gets really angry. His face gets contorted in anger. He commands his officers to crank up the fire to 7 times the intended heat, and he commands his strong men to throw them into the fire. They throw Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah bound up in their clothes into the fire. And the fire is so strong that, in fact, the people who throw them in are incinerated by the fire itself. That's how terrifyingly hot it is. At which point, the king jumps up in a chipazon, in a rush, and he turns to the bystander and he said, weren't they thrown in with clothes and bound? Weren't they tied up? And they affirmed, yes, they were tied up. So he says, but I'm looking into the fire and I can see four people walking around. There's no injuries to them. And he points out that the fourth being looks like some sort of celestial being. He then approaches the entrance of the furnace and he calls out, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the king on high, leave the furnace and come out. And they come out and everyone sees that they are unscathed, their clothes are not touched, and their hair is not singed. Who is the fourth figure? So it is clear that this is some sort of angelic being. Already Nebuchadnezzar himself identifies it as being an angel, and the Gemara in Sanhedrin corroborates this by saying that, in fact, that when tzaddikim act in such a way, they are greater than Malach HaSharis, in the sense that Hanan, Mishael, and Azariah were on the same level as the Malach that was there to protect them. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah Nun Gimel Amud Aleph. The next and section of the Perek is from Sukkim Chof Ches to Lamed, in which Nebuchadnezzar now gives honor to Israel. He turns to them and he says, you know, these three men decided not to abandon their God, and he did not abandon them. He sent them an angel to protect them, and they gave their lives and not to serve any other power than God. And then he issues an edict that anybody who would say anything amiss about the God of Israel would be cut up and their homes would be destroyed, and he promoted them in Babylon. And then it goes on, the last three Psukim are the beginning of a letter that he's writing, which actually follows into the next Perek, Perek Dalet, which he describes who he is. He's the King of Kings of all nations, and he describes the power of Hashem in this world, which is just should be a moment to pause and appreciate. When has such a letter been ever written by one of the most powerful people in all of that stage of history, and recognizing the greatness of the Almighty? It is worthwhile noting that we never afterwards hear about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah hereafter. What actually happened to them? So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Tzadi Gimel and Aleph, presents a few options. Could be that they passed away shortly afterwards, or could be that they moved to the land of Israel, that Barbanel suggests, that they were scared living around this volatile and terrifying person called Nebuchadnezzar, and therefore it was that they left his presence and they went away to Israel to live their life out in safety. And the lesson that Barbanel says we learn from this parasha is that even in God is at a time of Hester Panim, of hiddenness of Hashem, we should never forget the lessons of our college. Baruch Hu, that Hakadosh Baruch Hu has Ashkacha Pratis, he looks after all of us, and this is the reason why this story happened. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.